Now on BFBS, Richard Hatch and Hal Stewart bring you yet another dull aircraft documentary.
This is BFBS.
Stop what you are doing. A plane most people have never heard of has stopped flying.
Listen! It could be argued this plane swung the outcome of the Falklands War.
Shush! Without this plane, there would have been no Concorde and no space shuttle.
Settle down at the back! The Vulcan bomber became known as the People's Plane. It was built in the 1950s, but even now looks like something from the future.
This is Richard Hatch and Hal Stewart's documentary about the Vulcan, called The Vulcan Documentary by Richard Hatch and Hal Stewart.
In its day, this soaring eagle ruled the sky. It was a time when men were men and even the women were men.
It was a better time. Men with huge moustaches ruled the skies, protecting the smaller, weaker, less hirsute mortals.
These pilots, these brave, brandy-swilling, back-slapping, cigar-smoking, brilquine-donning heroes were the swaggering rock stars of the RAF. Is that the Queen on the telephone? Tell her I'll call her back.
In a few minutes, you'll meet one of these rock gods. He's the prodigal son of the Vulcan bomber. Oh yes, it's Martin Flippin' Withers. So, why is this Vulcan documentary important?
Is it because we've spent a lot of time making it?
No. It's more important than that. The Avro Vulcan, sometimes referred to as the Hawker Siddeley Vulcan, was a jet-powered delta wing, which is a wing shaped like a triangle.
The Vulcan was a strategic bomber, operated by the Royal Air Force and was the UK's nuclear deterrent for nearly 10 years.
It was part of what was called the V-Force with three other planes. So called, of course, because they all began with the letter F. Kidding. V.
The Vulcan bomber, by the early 80s, was falling apart and was about to be scrapped. Then, Argentina invaded the Falklands and the UK government suddenly needed a long-range bomber. Oh, what to do, what to do?
It was time for one last hurrah for the Vulcan. It was time for Operation Black Buck. Someone, get me Martin Flippin' Withers. But before all that...
Vulcan history.
Let's go back in time.
Everybody pinches my butter.
Hang on. Not that far back. Better. According to Frederick Forsyth, one of the world's leading thriller writers and former RAF pilot, Britain owes the Vulcan a big debt of gratitude.
It is a fool of a nation that does not honour its veterans and revere its saviours. Through its long career, the Avro Vulcan was both. At the height of the Cold War, through the most dangerous years, 1956 to 1969, silent and invisible, it patrolled the perimeters of hostile airspace. When tensions were at their highest, Vulcan held the line, saying by its presence to any aggressor, "Do not even try it." And they did not.
If you've never seen the Vulcan, what does she look like? A man who can tell us is Sebastian Cox of the Royal Air Force Historical Branch.
Well, for somebody who's never seen a Vulcan, what can they expect? If you imagine a classic paper dart, then you multiply it several hundred times, this fantastically beautiful triangular shape sweeping across the skies, almost blacking out the sun if it passes right over the top of you at low level. It doesn't just lumber up and down. It reminds one of the most amazing bird of prey in flight. But this is a man-made bird of prey.
The Vulcan became vital to the very survival of Great Britain and the rest of the Western world during the height of the Cold War. Once again, Sebastian Cox.
People are, these days, are not as aware as they were then of the looming threat of another war. And in that era, it would have been a nuclear war. And it was extremely important to deter that. In a way that we had not deterred Hitler, we needed to deter Stalin. You have to have nuclear bombers available to do that, They have to be available within 4 minutes. So, massive radar station up in Yorkshire at Fylingdales will give you 4 minutes warning of a nuclear attack. The Vulcans have to be off the ground within that 4 minutes, ready to go back and strike the Soviet Union.
As mentioned earlier, the Vulcan was part of something called the V-Force, which consisted of three planes: the Valiant, the Victor, and the Vulcan. If the V-Force was 90s pop band Destiny's Child, the Vulcan would be Beyoncé. And what's interesting is how adaptable the Vulcan turned out to be, just like Beyoncé.
She's not that adaptable, I mean, she hasn't done films.
She was in Dreamgirls.
That was an awful film.
Knew you'd seen it. Anyway, here's Frederick Forsyth. Seriously, you're telling me you don't like Dreamgirls?
I didn't mind Dreamgirls, it was overrated.
What a lot of people don't know about Vulcan was that the Vulcan and the American equivalents were designed to fly very, very high, at a height that the Soviet ground-to-air rockets would never reach them. But halfway through their careers, we became quite aware that Soviet rockets could reach them. And the only way to get through would be to convert from high altitude, ultra-high altitude, to extremely low altitude. And Vulcan converted immediately from ultra-high altitude, I mean hovering on the edge, if you like, of air, real air, down to skimming the sea. Same plane, same crew, different tactics, but what an aircraft.
The fear of actually being scrambled was very real during this time. BFPS defence analyst Christopher Lee, not the Dracula one.
I flew in a Vulcan, and this is just a sense of when you get into the aircraft. You've got five-man crew. Up at the top, looking out of the window, those tiny windows, you've got the pilot and the co-pilot. And they're in ejector seats. And the guys that have crawled through that little trap door in the belly of the aircraft, the other guys are down below. And down below, you don't have ejector seats. And somehow that always said to me that whatever we were told, it really was, during the Cold War, for a Vulcan, it was simply a one-way mission. One-way mission. Weren't coming back.
Now, from Armageddon and total global annihilation to
Christopher Vulcan Facts.
Hi, I'm Christopher Vulcan.
It's a great pun,
isn't it? There are 14 fuel tanks on an Avro Vulcan. Don't smoke. You know, Christopher Vulcan has a great memory. The Avro Vulcan's first flight was August 30th, 1952, only 7 years after the end of the Second World War.
And there'll be more from Christopher Vulcan coming up.
It's a play on the Hollywood actor Christopher Walken.
Operation Black Buck.
This was the name of the Vulcan bomber's most famous mission during the Falklands conflict.
Argentina has invaded the Falkland Islands, and its marines have taken control of the colony, which has been in British hands for almost 150 years.
Here's the background. Argentina had invaded the Falkland Islands in 1982. Britain needed to respond decisively, and a plan was hatched by head of the RAF, Sir Michael Beetham. Sir Michael went to Downing Street to see Margaret Thatcher, who was Prime Minister at the time, and his plan was to send two Vulcan bombers 8,000 miles down to the Falklands to blow up the runway at Port Stanley. It would stop the Argentinians from landing fast jets with which to target the approaching British task force. Psychologically, it was an important show of both strength and will to the aggressors.
This plan was ambitious in the extreme. The Vulcan bombers were falling apart. They were old. They were at the end of their service life. In fact, just before the outbreak of war, the entire fleet were just 3 months away from being broken up by bulldozers. Now, though, they had just 3 weeks to get the Vulcans ready for the mission. The refueling system no longer worked. Scrap heaps had to be raided for parts, and amazingly, one of the parts they needed was eventually found in the RAF Waddington crew room, being used as an ashtray.
It's time to introduce the first reserve pilot for the Black Buck mission, Flight Lieutenant Martin Withers.
Nobody knew what this bit of metal was that had been used as an ashtray in the crew room, but it hadn't been thrown out. It was actually a crucial bit to put onto the refuelling bowser so they could actually link it to the probe.
And the tape deck was playing up. But the biggest hurdle was the sheer distance to the Falklands and back, a total of 16,000 miles. This was double the Vulcan's range, even with a stop-off at Ascension Island. Add to that the challenge of using conventional bombs to hit a target just 40 metres wide. This would be the longest bombing raid in British military history. Cue imposing and thought-provoking music.
But we just could not see how it was possible in a Vulcan, because it wasn't equipped to go that far over the sea. It had no navigation equipment. We needed air-to-air refueling, which nobody had practiced for about 10, 12 years. The conventional bombing role, it had actually had everything stripped out of it. All those what we call bombing computers are the antiquated things. You wouldn't call it a computer now. And even the bomb racks that hold the bombs and all the release equipment had all been taken out and wasn't accounted for. Some was found sort of obscurely locked up in cupboards. Some bits were found in scrapyards. But there was so much to do to the aircraft, to equip it, to have any sort of jammers on that would counteract. Our jammers was just tuned to Russian frequencies. We just thought it was impossible, and it was inconceivable. And yet, 3 weeks later, there we were, flying with 11 Victor tankers, loaded up with conventional bombs, with inertial navigation system, a jamming pod plugged under the wing, and so on. It can only happen at a time of war, you know, that everything happens just like that.
Once at Ascension, Martin wasn't down to be the lead pilot for the raid.
I was the captain of the reserve crew, so I only thought I was getting airborne for 4 hours, about 2 hours down, and then the Vulcan would be refueled again. And as soon as any fuel had gone into the primary Vulcan, then that would have been it. He could have gone unserviceable further on. That was too late. So I expected to be flying 4 hours and then back in the bar. But the primary aircraft went unserviceable about a couple of minutes after takeoff. And so we got very early warning, much to our surprise. I wasn't going to be in the bar 4 hours later. In fact, we had a drink, I think it was about 16 hours later. So that was it.
And that tape deck still wasn't working.
2 miles from the target, Martin and his crew dropped 21 bombs. Only 16 exploded, and of those 16, only one was a direct hit on the runway. Despite this, the mission was a big success and played a significant part in the eventual surrender of the Argentinian forces.
Yeah. Is there a white flag flying?
There is a white flag flying over Stanley.
Very marvellous.
Our forces reached the outskirts of Port Stanley. Large numbers of Argentine soldiers threw down their weapons. Our troops have been ordered not to fire except in self-defense.
Stanley woke up to find it was back under British rule. Down from the mountains came the British troops, marching proudly through the town they'd come to liberate.
How are you feeling, lad?
Great.
They didn't look like men who just walked across the island, but they had every step of the way on their own 2 feet.
I never had any doubts in our armed forces. I knew it would be difficult, but I knew that they would do it.
Flight Lieutenant Withers was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for his actions.
Christopher Vulcan Facts.
On the tarmac, the Vulcan weighs, it's quite heavy, 45 tons. You're not going to believe this. I don't know how the thing gets off the ground. It's a miracle. Who could have thought that aviation fuel would weigh so heavy? Fully fueled, it's twice as heavy. Weighing, I can't even believe I'm saying this, 93 tons. That's a lot of weight. You know, I can just about lift my own body weight when I do some push-ups, but 93 tons, that's heavy. No one's going to be able to pick that up using string.
Air shows.
A great way of demonstrating aviation history to the general public is through air displays. Visitors not only get to see death-defying aerial acrobatic teams like the Red Arrows, but they can also get up close to famous warplanes like Spitfires, Hurricanes and Lancasters from organisations like the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. This aerial timeline continues right through to the present day, with the brand new F-35 Lightning the most technically advanced fast jet in the world. But of all the aircraft that you can see either on the ground, in the static display or turning tricks in the sky, it's the Vulcan bomber that always drew the biggest crowds, considered by air scholars to be the Justin Bieber of the air show.
And as we sort of line up to take off for our display,
you physically see the whole crowd moving towards the crowd line to watch us. So you realise that you are quite a main attraction at the air shows, and that actually is quite a humbling feeling.
That's Kev Rumens.
Hang on, Rumens. It's Rumens.
That's Kev Rumens.
No, it's Rumens. Rumens.
What I said. That's Kev Rumens.
Give up.
In the late 80s, Kev was a Vulcan display flight pilot who flew in the RAF for over 20 years.
Few planes have captured the public's imagination more than the Vulcan. So how did you get to fly one?
I was flying the Victor tanker on 55 Squadron at RAF Marham. And most of the guys who were involved with the Vulcan display flight at the time were also on 55 Squadron. And a position came up, a display co-pilot slot came up, and I was just right place, right time, and I was offered a chance to display the aircraft as an RAF pilot, which obviously I jumped at, and I displayed for two seasons. Unfortunately, when I left the Victor, I went to on a fast jet crossover. I was no longer able to carry on flying the Vulcan, so I just flew for two seasons in the RAF. But obviously now, as a civilian pilot, I've been flying since 2008, displaying the Vulcan as a civilian aircraft.
So how does Kev Rumens...
Rumens.
So how does Kev Rumens keep the crowd in the palm of his hand?
We try and display the aircraft to the public and fly the aircraft as slow as we possibly can, so that we're always directly in front of the crowd. And we've got four very powerful engines, so we can make a little bit of noise as well. So our display consists of steep turns, wing overs, but we try and maintain crowd centre. And you may have heard of the famous Vulcan howl. We can, if we apply full power to the engines do make a bit of a noise, which is quite popular with the public as well. So our displays primarily revolve around steep turns, wing overs, and a little bit of the use of full power during the wing over manoeuvres.
To explain a wing over in layman's terms, imagine a dog, a small dog, in a paddling pool. It's semi-full, the pool, not the dog. It hasn't eaten in hours, it's a sunny day. There's a family barbecue nearby. The paddling pool is blown over violently by a strong wind. The dog somehow manages, with quick reaction inversion, to ride the gust.
He doesn't know what a wing over is. A wing over, also called a wing over wing, crop duster turn or box canyon turn, is an aerobatic manoeuvre in which an aeroplane makes a steep climb followed by a vertical flat turn, and has nothing to do with dogs or paddling pools.
As Kev alluded to, the Vulcan bomber sounds like no other plane, and the reason for that is all down to luck. Oh, and the four Rolls-Royce Olympus engines. But it was the serendipitous arrangement of the wing air intakes which resulted in the Vulcan emitting its unique and legendary howl.
Don't just take our word for it. Here's a collection of people who've witnessed the Vulcan in full flight.
Well, I saw it at Cosford. I think it was 1997. It flew right over me. It was the loudest thing I've ever heard. So loud.
Yeah, it was so noisy and loud. It made this noise.
It's very difficult to put into words just how loud it was.
Well, it was, put it this way, right? See, when you're trying to speak to somebody and they can't hear the words and you're just mouthing shapes with your face, it's a lot louder than that.
It's not just noisy, and you don't really appreciate this until you're actually here, but it's very loud.
It's really hard to put into words how loud it actually was.
This is the loudest thing I have ever heard in my life. Extraordinary loud. Big loud. Bang, bang, bang loud.
If you've seen Memphis Belle, the movie, there's a moment toward the end, I think it's at the end, it might have been the beginning, not when it, we're at the end, I remember it, when Matthew McConaughey...
McConaughey.
Well, that's what I said.
No, you said mahogany.
I didn't say mahogany.
I think you did.
What was the question again? Why are you making a documentary about Matthew McConaughey?
So, there you have it.
Here's our howly list of other things that howl. Wookie, woman, angry woman, really angry woman.
According to the RAF's howl scale, 10 being very howly and 1 not so much, the Vulcan is a 10, which is on a par with actor Brian Blessed accidentally stepping on a plug.
Ah! Plug! Three pin! Hoi up! Ho! Ha! Ooh!
Competition time now, airshow fans. What is this anonymous old man about to say? He was there at the Vulcan's final flight in Doncaster in October 2015. Here's the clip.
The Vulcan, because it's the last iconic.
Does he say A, aardvark, B, aircraft, or C, does he never finish the sentence? The answer at the end of the show.
If you have been lucky enough to see the Vulcan bomber fly at an air show, you need to thank the Vulcan to the Sky Trust.
Quick history lesson now.
The final flying Vulcan was XH-558, which was lucky to still be around because, as we established earlier, the entire fleet was just 3 months away from being scrapped. That bomber was saved by an aircraft enthusiast called David Walton, who bought it for £25,000. About 10 years later, Robert Fleming, the CEO of the charity set up to preserve the bomber's rich heritage, the Vulcan to the Sky Trust, decided the great British public needed to see it fly again.
An interesting aside to this story is that Robert started off as an air cadet and then ended up being taught nuclear physics by Stephen Hawking. The project was turning into an expensive hobby for Robert, and his money was beginning to run out, so he applied for a heritage lottery fund. He was successful, and the trust was awarded £2.7 million, which, in plain terms, is about enough to fix the tape deck.
Add to that all the donations from fans, and in 2007, 14 years after its last flight, 558 was somehow back in the air, in front of its adoring public.
The cost to keep the Vulcan in the air every year was £2.25 million. Of that, a cool million went on the maintenance to keep it airshow fit for its 40 hours of annual airshow displays.
So why did the Vulcan bomber have to stop flying? Here's Robert Fleming speaking at the Vulcan's last appearance on the South Coast in 2015.
Sadly, the reason that we have to stop flying is unique to the Vulcan. The Vulcan is the only complex ex-military aircraft flying on the civil register. And as a result of the regulations that apply to complex aircraft, we have to have the contractual airworthiness design support from the original manufacturers, so people like Rolls-Royce and BAE Systems. And sadly, in January of this year, they came to us and said that we really don't think we've got the skills and experience to support you after the end of this year, so we are having to withdraw our support. And without that support, we're not permitted to fly.
Christopher Vulcan Facts.
The Vulcan bomber has 40 miles of cabling. I'm shocked, horrified. That's almost enough cables to go to the moon, but not back. So you're stuck on the moon thinking about the Avro Vulcan. I can think of worse things to think about. How am I going to get home? Can you send me some more cabling? No, technology's moved on. We've ditched half the amount of cabling now. It's a terrifying prospect. Be grateful you got to the moon and not halfway to Mars on an older version of the Vulcan. You'd be floating in midair. You'd be floating in space. There is no air in space. But in a Vulcan, anything's possible.
The future.
The Vulcan's last official flight was piloted by Martin Withers. It took place on Wednesday, the 28th of October, 2015, before arriving at its final resting place, Robin Hood Airport, in Doncaster. After 55 years of loyal service, the aircraft's new home will be its original 1950s Cold War hangar. Vulcan fans still wishing to see it can visit the Vulcan to the Sky Trust Visitor Centre and be able to see and hear it fast taxiing around the runways at Robin Hood Airport.
They say the Vulcan's last mission is to inspire the next generation of scientists, engineers, designers, and aviators. There's even an access program to provide lifelong learning to volunteers, special interest groups, and specky plane geeks, of which me and Hal are both members. Hello.
Hello.
This story, in our opinion, doesn't have a happy ending. And that's not because people haven't tried. On the contrary, hundreds of people from all walks of life have worked incredibly hard for years to keep the Vulcan story alive. And we're sure they'll continue to work tirelessly to promote the Vulcan and highlight its historical significance. The problem is, telling that story has now just become much, much harder.
Getting people's attention is something the Vulcan bomber has never struggled to do, in the air. But on the ground and lifeless, all planes become much less exciting. The Vulcan story is well known amongst the military community, and its story was beginning to cross over more widely into the national consciousness thanks to the recent airshow years. But that's all ended. The Vulcan bomber has always had that something extra. It was always just special. All planes are not made equal. The Vulcan was supposed to sit alongside the other V-Force planes, but in reality, it never did. It was the star. Crowds never queued round the block to see the others. For the Vulcan's last flight, organisers had to keep the details secret until the very last minute. The police were worried hundreds of thousands of people would turn up and swamp Doncaster. What other planes have groupies?
It didn't just look good. The Vulcan's revolutionary design is also credited as an important evolutionary stepping stone that led to Concorde and then the Space Shuttle. But for many people, it's the howl that will live long in the memory. We've heard stories about people falling off bikes when it flies past, ornaments falling off shelves, pelvic floors collapsing.
Everyone has said this aircraft will never fly again. But I suppose if you tell someone else about the Vulcan, and then, next time they're in Doncaster, they go and see it, and then they tell someone else about it, maybe at some stage in the future, when enough people know the story and care, then maybe the next time a funding window comes round, something could change. As it stands, if you never saw the Vulcan fly, you never will.
Sadly, the Vulcan story is now over. There'll be no last-minute reprieve this time. No final mission for Queen and country. That's it. And we think that's very sad. Yes, you can go and see this plane in a hangar, and from time to time, you can even see it taxiing with its engines on. But that's like seeing a tiger in a zoo. To appreciate the majesty of this living, breathing, swooping metal eagle, you need to see it where it belongs, where it lives and comes to life. And that's in the sky. Engines roaring like a prehistoric animal as it thunders overhead, blocking out the sun.
All we can do now is say, go to Doncaster, go to Robin Hood Airport and see it. And on the way out, leave a few quid in the collection plate, because it could make all the difference.
You won't help it fly again, but your money could pay to fix the tape deck.
That was Richard Hatch and Hal Stewart's documentary about the Vulcan, called The Vulcan Documentary by Richard Hatch and Hal Stewart.